At long last, ladies and gentlemen, season 5 of Chewing the Gristle is indeed upon us. A convivial conversation fest between myself, Gregory S. Cawk, Esquire, and a variety of musical potentates from hither and yon. Brought to you by our friends at Wildwood Guitars and our friends at Fishman Transducers, of course, both of which I've had long-standing and continuing relationships with, and I'm very grateful for their continued support in this endeavor to bring you Chewing the Doggone Gristle. We've got a bunch of fun guests, some you have heard of, some maybe not so much. It'll be a little bit of discovery and a little bit of chaos all rolled into one. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Now, without any further ado, let's chew some gristle. Folks, an individual that doesn't need any introduction. However, if I don't give him one, you won't know who the hell's coming up next. We got Eric Johnson, guitar potentate, music potentate, just a legend, and someone who I've admired for many years. I've had the pleasure recently of being able to jam with them and hang out a little bit, and now finally be able to sit down and have a little conversation via the inner Google to chew the gristle. So buckle up, folks. It's a good one. Eric Johnson on Chewing the Gristle. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we have convened once again for another rendition, if you will, of Chewing the Gristle with yours truly, Gregory Cawkery. And I'm here. It's my great honor and privilege to be hanging out with the mighty Eric Johnson. Eric, how are you? I've got my Saxon Pub t-shirt on.
Hey, just all right. Yeah, you just played there. You just had a great show there.
Yeah, we had a good old time, as a matter of fact. We always have a good time down in Texas. I like it down there.
Yeah, well, you need to come more often.
I would gladly do so. It's a lot warmer down there than it is up here.
Yeah, it's like 63 today.
That's not bad.
No, it's cool. It's great.
So you are in your studio there, it looks like. Is that at your domicile?
I am. I sure am. Yeah.
Awesome. Now, is that attached to the house or is it like a separate thing?
It's a separate place, but it's pretty close to my house. So
that's excellent.
Yeah.
And my little lair here that you had looked in back and said, what is that, your studio? This is my new room. So all during COVID, I was doing live streams from inside the house. And my wife was like, boy, it would be great if you could go someplace else. So it took a while, but now we rebuilt our garage. And then above the garage is this new room, which is where I have all my gear now. And technically, I had to say, and it is for all intents and purposes, my tempered storage facility. But it also functions as a great place to do these chats. And then we do my live streams from here and so on and so forth. So it isn't a recording studio per se, but more of like a, performance space, as it were.
Sure. Absolutely. That's great.
So I just saw you here in beautiful Milwaukee. And you were very kind to have me sit in. I enjoyed myself immensely. And you sounded fabulous.
No, well, thanks. I enjoyed playing with you. I always loved hearing you play.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, I really love the pacing of the show as well. I love the acoustic set. And it really sets a cool vibe. And then you unleash with the electric stuff. And it was just a very enjoyable evening. And what was interesting about it is my son and his girlfriend along. And she likes music, but she's not a music person per se. And my lovely wife is along and she, obviously she's forced to be somewhat musically inclined, but she's not a real, music-y person. And they both just loved it. They thought it was very entertaining just enjoyed the music. Instead of like looking at, I wonder what fuzz pedal he's using.
None of that. Yeah. They weren't concerned about the speakers in the speaker cabinets, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So how is that approach to performing live different than it has been in years past in terms of how you look at the whole thing? Pacing, gear, the whole nine yards.
Well, a lot of the gear really hadn't changed, Greg. It's kind of the same deal. I kind of just keep going back to the same old stuff. But I keep daydreaming about having less and less stuff and just like, because when I'm at home sometimes, I just take a guitar cord and plug straight into an amp. And that's my big fun,
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful feel to be immediately connected to the sound source. But yeah, that hadn't changed. But I mean, musically, just trying to branch out and do a little piano stuff and acoustic, and just kind of intersperse it with the guitar. Yeah.
It's glorious.
Yeah, it's kind of nice that I enjoyed the acoustic set on this last tour because I've done a number of acoustic tours and shows, but I've never done a whole set with like acoustic band, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and that was kind of different and fun.
Yeah, and old Roscoe on the upright. That's a nice touch.
Yeah. So that was a lot of fun. Yeah,
it was very enjoyable. And and Dave Scherr is a great addition to what you're doing. The other guitar player thing really works.
Yeah, he is. He's such a versatile musician. He plays drums, bass, guitar, keyboards, sings, writes music. He's a pretty amazing musician.
He is indeed.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And all these guys are good guys to travel with too. Everybody's,
well, that's no small issue.
No, it's not. That's true. It's good. Yeah.
I've always had very small bands because, I mean, I get along with most people, but I have a very low threshold for the idiosyncrasies of human beings. And it never leads to like confrontations. It's just like, I have an expression. My new expression I like is like, there's a last time for everything. And so I find two other people is just the right amount of humans.
Right. Totally. Yeah. Well, you've got pretty darn big sound for three piece. I'm not sure how you do that, but you cover a lot of ground, three piece.
Oh, well, Toby is, you know, he's got a lot to do with it. The organ player, he's, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people, they can't get their mind around left hand organ bass. You know what I mean? They're like, well, there's no bass player. I can't like this. It's like, well, actually, I always like to say that, you know, Toby's left hand is the best bass player there never was.
Yeah, totally. No, I mean, it didn't miss it at all. It sounded full and everything. That's great.
Yeah. So that's fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now are you home for the holidays here? What's on the immediate docket for what you have going on?
Well, we're going to go do this 2.5 week G3 thing with Joe.
Oh, that's right.
Mastriani and Steve Vai. Mostly on the West Coast. There's also Arizona and Nevada. But other than that, it's Washington, Oregon, and California. And they're going to film a little documentary on it, on the original G3.
A rockumentary, if you will.
Yeah, a rockumentary, right. I need to take notes how to do that instead. Final tap.
Now, do you enjoy doing that? I mean, I'm sure there is a level of enjoyment. Do you like doing package tours like that? I'm sure it's fun. And obviously, it's, you know, when you're with two other potentates like those guys, I mean, it obviously brings, you know, the whole anticipation level for the audience up a notch and so on and so forth. But do you like to do those types of package things, or would you rather just be out on your own? And of course, I'm not talking. I'm just curious.
I kind of like it all. There's pluses to all of it. It's nice going out with playing with other people because then you learn and you get to watch them and you get a little out of your own world and just
sure, absolutely, yeah.
And the camaraderie's nice. I remember I really enjoyed doing the blues tour with B.B. King many years ago. That was one of my favorite package tours.
Yes.
Every night was like going to school, you know?
Right.
That was great.
Well, it's interesting about B.B. because you know, when you listen to, you know, I know a lot of the guys that you like early on is a lot of the same guys I liked, especially when you listen to, you know, Blues Breakers, you know, Cream era Clapton and you know, all the other guys of that era, you know, from Hendrix to, you know, Johnny Winter, you know, Mike Bloomfield. You listen to all those guys and you can find in almost all of their landmark licks, if you will, something that ties directly to B.B. King. Because a lot of people just think, you know, B.B. was just in that little pentatonic zone and would hit that little octave thing at the top of the neck. And that was more of the latter B.B. But early on, I mean, he played, I mean, a lot of those like triplet, licks that we think that Clapton and Johnny Winter kind of flushed out a little bit more, but it's like B.B. did all that stuff.
Yeah, and those 50s records of him and they swing. The bands had this swing drummer, and B.B.'s got a little distortion on his amps because you know, the amps weren't as clean, and yeah, it's just killer. And yeah, he was a big Lonnie Johnson.
Exactly. Yeah,
he learned to play from, and he. to your point, he had a pretty wide berth of what he could play. He could play a lot of stuff that he didn't necessarily play on stage, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
I always thought it was interesting is that even in later years, you know, I remember this one particular time I saw him, you could tell his voice wasn't up to its usual. He had a cold or something. So he played more and he still had all that stuff. You know, he'd do those kind of Django-ish type of things to anticipate the chords a little bit more. And I was just like, good God, he just has it as a disposal to be unleashed at any point in time.
I know. It's really great. Yeah. And there's something so beautiful about that. You know, it is just that guitar chord straight in the amp. And to me, that I've been really enjoying practicing a little bit that way, because it's like it's almost like nowadays with, you know, there's 5,000 fuzz tones and 5,500 echoes. And it's like, wow, you know what? The only way to steer into a new domain sometimes is just to like go incredibly simple and straight ahead. And then you find that freedom and the limitation, you know?
Absolutely.
Because I don't know otherwise. It's like, God, I mean, you'd have to build a pedal board that was 20 feet long and try to get it all together. And then it's like, it's just too crazy. And then you're tripping over yourselves mentally, thinking about all the medium instead of the destination, sort of.
Right, totally. Well, let's be honest. You're going to sound like you, whether you're playing through, you know, the flux capacitor U47 or a guitar and a cord and an amp. But it's, as I like to say to folks, like all that stuff, they're just sonic enablers. They're just fun to create landscapes. But to your point as well, it's like all you really need to do is, you know, it's as a matter of fact, totally of taking everything away. Then you can really hear the nuances of the vibratos and just the way someone plays the instrument. You have a very specific way of just when you play chords and stuff like that, that really translates, especially in a clean instrument, as well as, you know, obviously with a little bit of heat on it as well. But yeah, I think it's totally a valid, you know, very valid point of just going straight in, bring something to the fore that in this day and age where it's just, there's so much stuff. I mean, I've kind of gotten to the point, I don't know about you, did you do TikTok at all?
I look at it every once in a while. Yeah.
TikTok to
a little commentary on our attention span, isn't it?
Right. It is.
Like, that's all the time I got. I'm 27. Let's move on.
Exactly. And I hate to say it, but I just, you know, I find myself getting dragged into it. But I see someone with a guitar and I just go right by it. I want to see the dog videos.
Yeah, right.
I want to see all, you know, all the stuff that has nothing to do with music. And
because
if I hear one more person, check out this new pedal that does this and that, or some guy telling me what to think about a classic rock album, or let's see this opera person react to a Led Zeppelin record. It's like, I don't need this. Show me the dogs.
right. Yeah. Yeah. And the dogs seem to be getting more amazing. I wonder if those are real, those ones where the dogs are talking. I mean, do you have a take on that? I mean, it's like some of them are like, really? Did that dog really say that? Because
right.
There's one right now where the dog comes up to the lady before she leaves the house and goes, where are you going?
Right.
I'm like, that can't be real.
Right. I saw a cat one the other day where it was saying stuff too. I was like, this is skullduggery.
Yeah. Right. But you know, I don't know. I've had this vibe for the last few years that in 200 years, dogs maybe can learn to talk. I don't know why I think that, but I mean, they're just so, they're so connected and attached to humans that, and they seem to be getting smarter. So I mean, the vocabulary is pretty amazing right now.
Yeah. Cats as well.
We're getting dumber and they're getting smarter.
Exactly. Planet of the dogs. Well, let me ask you this. Are you, I don't know if you're this way, but I get up in the morning. I'm okay with just sitting in the corner playing guitar for an indefinite amount of time until the crushing weight of duty of needing to do things right. Are you still that way? Do you still just love playing?
You know, I do. Sometimes I like to just kind of get myself together mentally or spirit-wise in the morning, you know, kind of just check in. But yeah, there is a certain, it is nice to play when you're still not quite awake, because then you're not in the way of yourself as much and you can just enjoy it. Like, it's almost like we've learned all this stuff our whole life in our trajectory, and just to return back home to when we were a teenager and we just played because it was like, oh, I just, our eyes wide open and they're like, oh wow, that's, you know, and there's no judgment, no, it's just like, just for the joy of it, you know. And
right,
I wonder if that's where we're going to end up after we take this huge trajectory, just if we're, you know, just to, because of the beauty of it. And then maybe we're closer to that in the morning, I guess, when we wake up.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, you know, a thing I just thought of when you were talking about that, I was talking to my buddy Reggie Hamilton yesterday, and he was talking about studying with Dennis Sandoli. And, you know, you talk to a lot of people. I was talking with, you know, when I was out at Fishman, talking with Larry Fishman about how a guy he studied with at Berkeley was also Mike Stern's teacher. And it was one of these things where they were under this arduous ear training regimen where they'd go in and they would have to be able to do all of this stuff, which I certainly never did in college. I mean, I did go to school for music, but I really majored in beer, if we're honest. I'm not recommending it, but it happened. And I'm just curious. I mean, your ears are obviously fantastically, harmonically advanced, but I'm curious, did you go through a phase where you went through, like, you know, massive ear training in terms of having to, you know, okay, well, here's a note. Now spell out this chord and so on and so forth. Sing it in solfege. Now do it in all 12 keys, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, when I was, I started music when I was 5 playing piano, and I played piano. I didn't start guitar till 11, but I don't know, my teacher, Orville Weiss, she part of the curriculum in my private piano lessons was we wouldn't be able to see the keyboard, and she'd like go, what note is this? What note is that? What chord is this? It was like, she always did that. I guess she was trying to teach us natural ear theory.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But what happened? I didn't know what she's doing, but I developed where that's a C. Oh, that's a G. That's a fifth. That's a third. That's a, you know, you learn. I think, you know, maybe people are born with perfect pitch, or maybe some people can just learn it, you know, from repetition. But you learn the relationship of the notes. And so, yeah. And then all my theory came from just kind of spelunking around and making mistakes and hunting and pecking and trying to figure stuff out. And it's been more, I mean, I can read music and I understand because I took theory and piano, but I'm not very good at it now. I mean, I'm a very, very terrible reader. I know how to read, but I just don't keep it up.
Yeah, I'm the same way. It's like chord charts I can read down, no problem. But if I have to do a session, I remember when I used to do jingles back in the day. And
you were talking about one of those sessions where you showed up and it was all in like written notes.
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, my God. You just got to find, you know, wherever the single notes are. And try to woodshed it as quickly as possible. But, you know, and that was part of the thing. I think, you know, another thing I was talking about with Reggie back in the day or yesterday about back in the day is that there's, you know, the expectation of musicians as far as being technically astute, I think, was much more arduous back then because there weren't, I mean, when I was in college, I remember they used to use the phrase, well, you know, down in Chicago where they do all the jingles and all the different, you know, TV soundtracks and whatnot that they were doing at the time. You know, they don't run it through once in the studio to make sure you can play it. They run it through to make sure the notes on the page are right because it's assumed that you're all ace sight readers. And of course, I was like, oh my God, this is terrifying. My sight reading is horrible. And the first session I did, I went and I was petrified. And I just realized, they have the chord charts and you are just expected to, you know, be cognizant of the chords, obviously, but then just do your thing.
Yeah.
You know, back in the radio days where it was live bands and the radio, everyone had to sight read and, you know, and be able to do it. Mm-hmm. But as time's gone on, none of that is really expected. So it's you wonder what the technical skill set that's necessary for being a musician these days is more how you're able to edit videos for social media.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, it's right too. And it's just weird. I mean, you kind of wonder where it's all going. I think everybody's always going to want to hear some person, you know, just really play the violin and watch the hairs of the bow, you know, kind of fall off. Just that experience. But, you know, it's weird. I mean, in a lot of functions, I don't know. I mean, AI is just going to be the sign of the times for background music, movie soundtracks, any kind of dance rave ups. I don't know if they really need to have people. And now AI can cock the whole thing, can make up the whole music, you know. It's weird.
Well, the one thing that seems to, as you said, One thing that still seems to resonate with more people than not is when they actually experience music in person, they understand something's going on.
Yeah.
I think, you know what I mean? And I think there's people that are attuned to that. I think, you know, of course, there's a whole lot of, I mean, like, for instance, all of my, when I was a kid, one of the things I used to love was when you would go to a family wedding is that you'd see a band. And I would just sit there in awe as they loaded their stuff up and, you know, and plugged everything in. I was like, wow, you know, just the whole thing. And I realized that, you know, my brother has, you know, five kids and there's all these different weddings that we went to and not one of them had a live band at their wedding. And I think that that's such a rare thing that the whole idea of a live band is just not as prevalent in society as it once was. And maybe that'll lead to, you know, a rebirth of it being cool and for some like a novelty in a way that, who knows?
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, it's a different thing. It's interesting, but yeah. I saw something about I'm working on a new project where I want to make this record where it's really, you know, if I'm doing anything besides just a guitar and amp, it's like one pedal, you know?
Right.
And awesome. Because I don't know, but you know, there's a certain tonality to it, but there's also a, there's a disconnect when you go through a ton of electrical stuff and trying to get back to make it, get in contact and get in touch with that inner verve, you know? And
yeah, absolutely.
So that's kind of what I'd like to do on my next record project.
And as you think about that, what would your format be, more Fendery clean as your amp or that you would goose with said thing,
well,
or would it be more of a Marshall-y thing?
I think it's going to be like a Marshall and a twin reverb with an AB switch and maybe one overdrive pedal, you know. And it's nice playing the Gibsons because you can get a really nice lead tone, and but you know the Fender thing is tough because the pickups are weaker. But yeah, but it's nice, and I don't know. I'd like to just kind of return to my roots and make a record that, you know, it's like kind of blues, very blues rock flavored.
Yes, delicious.
Yeah, and I love that stuff, and I never get tired of it. So I'll see what happens.
Interesting that you should say that, because I find myself, you know, gravitating more towards, you know, the rootsier stuff that made me want to play in the first place. And then I start thinking about, you know, the initial, you know, Hendrix and Cream Era Clapton and, you know, and all that stuff. And then listening and then going, okay, well, I'm reading about these guys and, you know, who's this Albert King, you know, and who's BB King and who's Muddy White. And then going backwards and trying to figure out all these different things. Mm-hmm. And I just realized there's just such an emotional connect that I have to that more, you know, simpler but emotive music. But as I went on, you know, it was one of those things where, well, there's all these other technical things that have come along. I need to be up to snuff on this, that, and the next thing. Mm-hmm. And then you get caught up in it and so on and so forth. And then you just realize that you'd just rather keep it simple as opposed to, and it's not a cop out either. People are like, oh, well, you can't play that stuff anymore. It's like, no, I can. It's just that it feels better to do this other thing. I mean, do you have some of that?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, you know, our mutual friend, Gary, you know, he plays a lot of music nonstop at his house, you know, and it's all beautiful. It's all incredible. And like kind of, you know, but to your point of what you're making, it's like every once in a while Sam Cooke comes on, or Wes Montgomery with Jimmy Smith, or B.B. King, or just this really just stripped down, intimate, emotional, simple. But it's the music's not simple, but it arrives in your emotive psyche simply, you know, because it's coming from that place of just, you know, just altruistic heart space or whatever. I don't know. You know what I mean? And so it can be playing like crazy, but it has this thing. And like you say, I mean, that's the stuff that all of it, it just catches my eye. Like, oh my God, that's just so, there's so much connective emotion there.
Yep.
And it makes me kind of like retrospective, you know, look at what I'm doing and like, you know, getting like going off in that whole goose chase of complexity. And I, you know, wondering, you know, maybe there's a bigger horizon with limited tools, you know, because then you have to rely on a different factor of yourself to come up with the breadth. And you have to use your imagination and your intention instead of the tools at hand. Now, and that puts you on the spot a little bit, you know, I guess, you know, it puts me on the spot for sure.
Absolutely. I think it's you know, they're just different things. You go through different phases where it's fun to have the whole, you know, toolbox at your disposal. But sometimes, as you said, to do the job, you only need X and Y, and then off to the races you go. But you know, I remember when we were over at old Gary's a few months back and we were talking, and I didn't want to embarrass you by saying this, but I felt, you know, because we were talking about Jeff Beck. And we were talking about, he had just passed at the time, and how Jeff was just so, I mean, you can't really find a guitar player or a fan of rock and, you know, fusion, whatever you want to say, that isn't a Jeff Beck fan. I mean, every now and again, you'll come across a heretic. They'll be like, oh, I don't like that. And then you'll usually find out that they're a serial killer or something like that. But almost without doubt, everyone loves Jeff Beck. And he was always, you know, tweaking his game. And he affected every guitar player that came since. And I just said, well, you're the same way. I mean, there was before Eric Johnson and there is after Eric Johnson. And so many of the, you know, the way that you write songs, the way that you voice chords, the way that you do leads, the way, all the different things that you've culminated into your own thing. I mean, you're definitely on the Mount Rushmore of guitar players. If that's where you want to be, you're there in that cold South Dakota landscape. There you are.
Frozen in time. That's for sure. Well, you know, thank you. I'd like to be a part of the club, you know, but there's people like Jeff, he had to invent it, you know, and that's the difference between me and him. I have a lot of library books to resort to and people like him that blazed the trail when there was no trail. I mean, there was the great players of ever since the 20s and maybe even beyond, but as far as, you know, the standout guitar of rock music or, you know, starting in the 50s. I mean, there wasn't a lot of trail opened up before Jeff. I mean, he had to invent this stuff, him and Hendrix and stuff. And
right.
But, I can't really assume the same position by any stretch, but I like to just be part of the club and keep the thing going, you know, keep the amp off standby at least.
Yes. Well, in some ways, you know, it's even more difficult doing what you did, having had those people as, I mean, because you took, you know, Chet Atkins and Jerry Reed and mixed it with Bill Connors and Jeff Beck and Hendrix and Cream Era Clapton and the older blues influences and Wes Montgomery, and you did your own spin on it. And that's no small feat. So,
yeah, I think, and that's the originality of a player is just their, who they infuse into their musicality, and for better or for worse, ever since I was a kid, and I think my dad liked so many different types of music, and he would listen to show tunes and swing music, and I just remember it kind of stuck with me, and I just remember being a kid and just liking all kinds of music. And I remember the Carpenters would come on the radio and go, God, these guys are great. I mean, because Richard Carpenter, he is great. I mean, his voicings with background harmonies. I mean, the guy's really, but I mean, point being, I mean, you've got all these great musicians that invent awesome music, and it might not be in your, bag repertoire of what you want to appreciate or listen to, but you can't denounce it. It's just like great, you know, and I don't know, in a way, I think it's not all good to get, so because you're kind of like a bumblebee that's flying around on 25 flowers instead of concentrating on three. You know, maybe you'd be a lot better if you, but I never did that. I just always like flitting around trying, oh, I like that. I like this, you know, and you could never decide, you know, because it's all great.
Right. Absolutely.
And I mean, you're kind of that way too. I mean, you love all the styles of playing. I mean, you hear the country and the blues and the rock and everything, but so it keeps it, I think if one of the big things is it keeps it interesting for yourself,
you right.
know? You have exactly. a bigger well, you know? And so, you know, but I don't, you know, and people, I don't really think I'm necessarily original. The only original thing is the people that I pilfered from, you know, you know, like, I mean, there was a point where all I did was play Wheels of Fire note for note. And so, and I remember people would come up to me and go, what, you know, you're just copying Clapton lick for lick, you know? And I thought, okay, I'll quit doing that. But I'm glad I went through that period. And like I tell, whenever I do some masterclasses, I tell kids, you know, there's all sorts of chapters in your journey with music. And if there's a chapter where you copy somebody note for note, that's okay, you know?
Right.
Exactly. That's how you get inside their head. And if you really get serious and really, the very microscopic might be the wrong word, but you learn all the little inflections, little things about, you know, like just playing a Clapton lick, but no, you got to learn how you stretch the strings, the vibrato, the tone,
absolutely,
the whole nine yards, you know? So,
right.
you know, if you get stuck there for your whole life, that's not good. But going through that period, it's a means to an end, you know?
So, absolutely. I like to say you want to learn how to speak in the vernacular of that person without becoming the person.
Exactly. Yeah.
We interrupt this regularly scheduled gristle-infested conversation to give a special shout-out to our friends at Fishman Transducers, makers of the Greg Kock signature Fluence Gristle Tone pickup set. Can you dig that? And our friends at Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, bringing the heat in the shadow of the Rocky Mountains. I don't know if you wigged out on this one as much as I did, but that live Cream Volume 2 version of Steppin' Out, I just thought...
Oh, man. Isn't it great?
Oh,
God. It's just great.
I still can't... When it comes on, I've got to listen to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then I would, you know, I would work on the little vibratos and the little... You know, all those little triplets and just how he bends the triplets. And, you know, to your point about the minutia of making those sounds...
Yeah.
And it's just, I just thought to myself, man, if I could do one thing and have that stuff down. And then all I could imagine was, imagine if Clapton would have kept that tone and then in the way that he phrased and then continued on and maybe learned just a little bit more harmony and maybe did this. I just loved the way that he articulated so much in that era and realized that it pretty much happened then and it was done. It was donezo.
Yeah, and that's neat about how Jeff, he just stayed a student of the guitar, didn't he?
Yes.
He was just so mesmerized and just loved guitar. He loved music, period, so much that it just fueled him to keep experimenting and growing and doing stuff. And yeah. I think Hendrix would end up that way, too. You know,
I think so, too. That way, yeah, he definitely loved playing so much that I think he would have kept on going.
Yeah.
But you wonder how much, and I've contemplated this a little bit, like when you think about, you know, not to beat down Clapton, but someone like Clapton or Jimmy Page, you know, or any number of different people of the rock world that have this meteoric, like unfathomable success. That kind of like Jeff was successful, but was never like a household name, you know what I mean? You wonder how much that had a bearing on his hunger, you know what I mean? Versus I've filled every stadium that there ever was, you know, I can have the worst night in the world and be in a different tuning and people still call me great, you know, which is what Jimmy Page and, you know, Clapton, I think what he said was one night Cream was playing and they were playing someplace and they were at the height of their popularity and he was already over it. And at one point, the amps just went on and made feedback and the whole crowd went crazy. And he thought, I don't even have to play. And they're going crazy. You know, like he was so bummed out about there wasn't really, it became about something other than music. And I wonder if that level of success kind of deprives you of that drive to improve. Or by the same token, maybe Beck was always filled, you know, I'm just using these people as examples, of course. Beck was always filled with the idea that it was always about the music, whereas maybe other people, the music was just a means to an end, and their end was that meteoric stardom. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't. And I think in Eric's case, I think he just loved writing songs, and he's a great singer. I love
totally. Yeah,
I think the fact that he was a good band leader, and he had other aspirations for a bigger band. He wanted to write songs. He wanted to sing. He wanted to get down to, you know, more like J.J. Cale vibe. It just
right.
He grew up on a lot of that stuff. I think that was a big part of his DNA.
Right.
So, I think for me to go, well, you know, why didn't he just play Crossroads for the rest of his life? You know, I personally think that maybe we could have taken some of that along with the ride of what else he did, but that's just my opinion. But I mean, he went on to do this whole other aspect of music that I think was always with him and he always loved. And so from his point, I guess he was just dilating stuff that was already there.
Right.
And I'm an outsider looking in, and I don't know, you know, but yeah, I mean, it is interesting about, and I think, you know, I don't think it's about the gear, but I do think there's a certain thing about, obviously it's not about the gear, but there's a certain thing, like we're talking about simplicity, you know, you get a certain, purity of sound. And there's a certain way, like those old amps were copied off the 50s Fenders, which were copied off of radio,
right?
40s radios, and they're super simple circuitry, and there's nothing there really
right.
compared to nowadays. And when you, as soon as you start, it's like a recording console, same thing. You start at any situation, you start adding all this stuff, you pay a price, right?
Certainly, yeah.
And in a way, you can take a you can take a nice, real nice guitar and an old Tweed or an old Marshall, and you can just, I don't care how you set it, turn it up. You're going to kind of sound like Cream, you know what I mean? That's the sound, you know? I mean, it's just, it's almost like that's the home base of distorted electric guitar. In the early B.B. King records where it's distorting, it has that same, it's on the verge of the same thing, you know, or the Freddie King, you know, or Albert King with the, you know, crosscut saw or whatever. There's that always starting to, or Freddie King had it too. And it's just simplicity of the electronics. And I think if sometimes maybe it was just a moment in time when, when I don't know, that's a really interesting thing. Why? And I don't think that everything should stay the same, but sometimes as we progress or journey forward, there was something from the past. We should have carried that along with us, maybe, or something, you know?
Right. I guess that's because I'm a fan of what he did since then. You know, obviously I like the songs and all of his different eras to me were interesting, and he did cool stuff. It just, I guess the only thing that kind of makes it a little peculiar to me is what you mentioned, the fact that he didn't carry some of that along. And it's almost as if, it's like he wasn't cognizant of the power of that. You know what I mean? Like he thought it was almost like a bump in the road where it's like, yeah, that just got too out of hand. And what I really meant to do was this, which I can appreciate too. I mean, if what an artist wants to do, they should do. And the crowd can either embrace it or not. So I'm all about that. But as a fan, you know, it would have been nice to just like, yeah, but how about just, you know, doing a little bit of that?
and I think some of his playing is really just great nowadays. I mean, he still plays great. It's just a different sound.
Exactly.
It's a different sound, I guess.
It's a different vibe altogether. Not that, but again, I probably have purchased every record he's ever done. I can't think of too many that I haven't.
Yeah.
Because I just enjoy, you know, what he does and so on and so forth. And but I do like to listen to those old bootlegs. I go on YouTube and I'll find any, and of course I always try to
have you heard that one, the Meet Me at the Bottom?
Oh yeah, it's awesome.
But Clapton and Bruce and Baker, like the first three notes, it's like I don't need to hear anymore. That's just like I've just gone to heaven,
right? Because like they had more of the Blues Breakers tone on that. It was early on.
That sound is, you know, I mean, and people get inspired by different things, but that was a huge part of why I wanted to play guitar. That's for sure.
Yep. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Good, clean fun. So did you ever, were you too young to go see Cream or did you see them?
Never saw. I've actually never seen Eric Clapton live ever. Well, actually that's, I've never seen him play live before. Yeah.
Wild. Mm. Crazy business. So speaking of people that you saw live, what are some of the shows that you saw that you're like, oh my God, this is really kind of shaped the way I'm going forward in some way, shape or form?
Well, you know, God, there's so many of them, you know, but I do remember being 14. I just turned 14 and my parents were out of town. And so we, little did they know, but I had an older friend that had a driver's license. And so we took the station wagon and drove to Houston to see the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Oh!
I was like, I can't miss this show. You know, I was really had no business being in my parents' car, you know, when they were traveling, you know, 150 miles out of town. But I had a friend that was 3-4 years older than me. And so we went to the show and it was right when Electric Ladyland had come out. He was really great. But it's an interesting thing. I mean, like if you look back at that time period, nobody was doing what he did. You know, nowadays people, they hear Jimmy and think, okay, well, yeah, and there's this and that. But if you take it and you put it back in the time period it was right. Like somebody landed from another planet.
Exactly.
I mean, nobody was doing it. But I just remember just sitting there going, I don't have a clue what this guy's doing. I mean, I was really enjoying it, but it was just like, I mean, it might as well have been Stockhausen or Schulenburg or, you know, like I just no clue. And I just remember it was really momentous. And, but there's been a lot of great, you know, the security tour with Peter Gabriel, you know, that was unbelievable. And there's so many great shows that, where, you know, seeing Albert King live was pretty great. Yep. Or Freddie King. I remember seeing Freddie King. In fact, I went backstage to introduce myself to him. And I was like, man, can I come play with you? I was like 17 years old. Yeah, please play with you. And he said, yeah, okay. And the next time I come, you can, you know, stand behind me and play some stuff or whatever. But he passed away before I had the chance. But he was pretty amazing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So were you a fan of Hendrix, obviously, before you went and saw him? Or were you kind of a fan and thought, let's check him out? Or were you...
No, I was, yeah, because I'd rarely listened to the first records. But I remember a friend of mine brought the Are You Experienced record back from New York. And I was, you know, barely 13. And I was reading the back of the thing, and it says, with the assistance of Mitch Mitchell on drums and Noel Redding on guitar. It doesn't say bass guitar. If you look at the back of Are You Experienced. So I thought Noel Redding was the guitar player. So I'm thinking, well, I guess this Jimi Hendrix gentleman plays bass, I guess, because it says Noel Redding on guitar. You know? But I remember listening to the guitar and just saying, I mean, at the time with the feedback and the fuzz, it was just, I didn't even know. Sometimes I thought, is that even a guitar? I don't even know what that is.
Right.
But after a while, it took me a while to get it. But and then I was like, oh, this is really great. But you know, with the Blues Breaker record, that was instantaneous.
Right.
Kind of like.
Kaboom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you should say about, you know, people these days when they hear, I think the youngsters, they hear Hendrix, especially there's such a preponderance of stuff that was released posthumously that, you know, Jimmy would have never approved of it being released.
Yeah, and I have mixed feelings about that, what you say. Because, you know, when you get a pioneer, an experimenter, like a great scientist, they have a lot of experiments. Oh, that didn't quite work. Let me go back to the thing and try it again. I mean, that you can't come up with this incredible nuance of beauty unless you go way out on the limb.
Right.
And that's going to happen a lot, you know.
Right.
And that's why he was so great, is because he'd take those chances. But the tape was running on some of those chances, and now we're putting that out as gospel for kids to go, this is ultimate Jimmy. But no,
right.
there's really just these prescribed records that he approved of, you know. And
right, exactly.
But I agree with you. And And when you look at those, then you really get the genius of, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things. And even at, I'm sure you're the same way. It's like years go by and your ear gets better and better as you work on your own stuff and so on and so forth. And you go back and you'll listen to them. You're like, no, it's still awesome.
Yeah, totally.
Electric Ladyland. I mean, I remember all of them. I mean, my, you know, I roomed with my brother who was 14 years old, is 14 years older than I am. And there were five girls in between. So I had to room with my brother, which I'm sure he didn't appreciate. But I was exposed to all of his records. And Hendrix for me was, I don't know what it was. I remember when I was a little kid and I'd have to take naps and I would make them put on a radio station EXP. You know, I would listen to Axis Bold as Love before I'd go to sleep. Wow. And I just was a huge Hendrix fan. And I do try to think to myself, okay, kind of separate the myth and kind of the orthodoxy of, the magnitude of what Hendrix was versus the actual quality of what he did and how it holds up against time. And I have to say, I mean, to me, it's just the emotive quality of what he did is still unsurpassed, both as a songwriter and how we would arrange stuff. And then, you know, as far as like, you know, Band of Gypsies to me, I mean, just as a live performance thing. And again, there's an example of something he was horrified to release because he thought he was out of tune. And if that says anything to the scale of what he would have approved of this other stuff that has come out since, I mean, it's a pretty good indication that none of that stuff would have seen the light of day. But as a fan, I love it because I love all the other stuff. So it's cool for me to hear all that other different stuff. But and you know, when you, to this day, it's like I hear, you know, Machine Gun or you know, Message to Love or Power of Soul or any of the recorded stuff. And it just, to me, it still hits, it gets me in the feels, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's great stuff.
It's weird. It's like, you know, I'm 57 years old now. I've been listening to this stuff since, you know, I was, you know, a preteen. And I still love it as much now as I did then. It's just as weird.
It's timeless, isn't it? It's timeless music.
Yeah.
It is. It's as fresh today as the day it came out, I think.
It's wild. It's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, there was just that era of music that I think, you know, I mean, from a music business point of view, it just seems that, you know, Frank Zappa would I don't know if you've ever seen that little interview with him where he's talked about it. It's like, well, there was a point in time in the 60s where it wasn't the hip groovy people that were in charge of record companies as far as choosing what got released and what didn't. It was these old cigar chomping guys like, I don't know what this is, just put it out and see what happens. And as a result, enough cool stuff was able to just get through, you know, the arbiters. And then all of a sudden, then the nephews of the cigar choppers took over who thought, oh, we really know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. That's really well said. That's true. It is kind of, well, you know, when Jimi Hendrix came out in America, it was because he had had so much luck in England. They were like, well, we don't know what to do with this. We're not interested. And then it blew up so much in England. They were like, well, we don't know what it is, but we're going to do it because it's people like it. You know?
Right. Yeah. The kids love it.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know you, but one of my favorite things is I see those talking about bringing it back to the basics. I love those pictures of Hendrix going through the crowd on the way to the stage with his guitar, his fuzz face, and his wah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's his pedal board. Yeah.
And then with the cops in front of him. Okay, it's time to go play. And then the guitar is just leaning up against the amp. I mean, they didn't even get to have guitar stands back then.
I know. It's old school to the man. Yeah, there wasn't no such thing as a pedal board.
That's so wild. I remember, I don't know if I told
PA. It's like really not much of a PA.
Either. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I remember Ed King from Lynyrd Skynyrd. He was in Strawberry Alarm Clock and they did a tour with Hendrix.
Oh, wow.
And he told the story about he was in a dressing room with his guitar just kind of hanging out and they whisked Jimmy in but right before he went on stage. And Jimmy was like changing his strings frantically. And his roadie took one of those kind of, vendor's boxes of Snickers bars and opened it up and just started unwrapping one after another. And Jimmy would just go, just be devouring one after another before he goes on stage. And I was like, Jimmy, even with candy bars, he hits it out of the park.
Oh, that's great. That's an awesome story.
He needed a quick pick-me-up, and the Snickers was the one.
That's it. That'll do it. Wow. That's great.
Wow. You know, just from a gear point of view, I don't want to get into all, you know, the minutiae of germanium versus silicon or any of that kind of stuff. But at what point did you realize that the fuzz tone was the centerpiece of your lead tone as opposed to a more of an overdrive thing? At what point did you say, this is my thing?
Well, I kind of do both of them concurrently. I do the tube driver thing for like a tube overdrive, and then I do the fuzz face for a fuzz.
Gotcha. Okay.
I like the sound of the fuzz, but then I like the sound of the overdrive too. And I like them. But I guess it was back in the early 80s, I just kind of got into the fuzz thing.
Right.
More, you know, I mean, I was using other fuzzes before that, but I kind of got into the fuzz face because it's such a weird animal. I mean, a lot of them just don't sound very good, but you get one that works right, and it's like pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, when we talked about the Jimmy thing, it's like, I think he had that fuzz on a lot of the time, and then he would just roll back the volume and it cleans up so nice, and then turn it up and it's the end of the world.
Yeah. There's that, you probably heard it, that sound clip of just Jimmy's guitar from Third Stone from the Sun without the bass and drums. And it's that might be the best sounding rock guitar tone I've ever heard in my life. I mean, right. You can tell like what you're saying. He just turns it down. He has this crystalline clean rhythm, and then he just turns the volume up and it gets all distorted.
Right.
It's pretty great. It's really great.
And to think that back then they were just like, well, these are just the things that are available to use.
Right, exactly. Just happenstance, just like serendipitous stuff that just kind of fell into their laps. Yeah.
It's crazy. Now, were you ever a Univibe fan? Did you ever kind of go that route?
I appreciate them. I like the way they sound. I don't really use them very much. I guess I just use a course for my clean tone. But
right.
I like the Univibe thing. Yeah, it's cool. I use it in the studio.
It's a funny thing. I love Univibes, but it's like the minute you hit one, it's like people always comment, oh, that reminds me of Trower. And you're okay, well, yeah, he definitely used one, and and that was all well and good, but it was really Jimmy who started. But it's amazing how people just hear a sound and immediately.
That's their thing, yeah.
Yeah. Really. But what are you going to do?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
So what kind of stuff are you listening to these days that's inspiring you, or do you not really listen to all that much new stuff?
Oh, you know, I probably don't listen to a lot of new stuff.
I'm the same way, to be honest with you.
I do when it comes into my consciousness from somebody who'll play me something, you know, that I really dig. Like there's a lot, I mean, I check out stuff on YouTube and like, you know, new players and stuff. And I'm still really mesmerized and really enjoying a lot of the old school stuff, including like swing stuff from the 40s and stuff. Yep. Just like I'm going back and listening to that going, man, what a vibe.
Yeah.
You know, and like you were saying, you know, earlier, you know, those guys, if you didn't bring it, you didn't get the job, you know.
Right.
It's like you had to be able to sight read, and you had to come in and nail it in one or two takes. But there's a certain, that people step up, you know,
right.
You have to step up, and you can hear in the recordings. And I just think it, I mean, I'm enjoying listening to it just on a standpoint of music, but I'm also, it's kind of therapeutic for me because it's kind of, it's breaking down a lot of the alphabet that I've congealed over the years, which is, oh, we got to do this 50 times and you got to have this huge, you know, amount of gear and it's got to be perfect. And, you know, and I think even if that, I wouldn't profess that, oh, it's got to be perfect. No, I'm not that way. But I mean, really in reality, there was a part of me that's been that way, you know, cause you can accept the humanity of others, but you can't accept it in yourself. You're because it's like a lack of confidence almost, you know, oh no, I gotta be like, every note's gotta be perfect because I won't like myself if it's not. And it's, so I'm really like going, it's like sound therapy, going back to this music that's just busting my chops, you know,
and sure, I get it.
Bigger picture. And, it's a really it's one of the most comfortable, uncomfortable chairs I've ever sat in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And I'm digging that. It's almost like, I think at some point you decide what's most important to you. And it's that joy of music and getting back to that elevation and bring on whatever it is that makes that happen, you know? And another thing, you know, like letting people give you constructive criticism and, you know, really just be honest with you, you know? And I'm like, all that stuff is like that. I used to be kind of, I'd be a little closed or defensive. Now I'm like, man, bring it on. Cause really I want to feel the exhilaration of that real high ride, you know? And I've got, there's stuff I have to do to be eligible. You know, I got to be able to hear criticism, or I got to let go or let mistakes or listen to this organic honesty, you know? And so that stuff, you know, it's kind of a long-winded thing, but you asked me that question, but I think the music that pushes that button or step is in that pulse is what really I'm enjoying.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
Well, to that end, are there some things that you discovered that were older that you kind of missed the first time around and all of a sudden, like, you know, I never listened to this cat, but now that I've looked back, this is inspiring me in a way that I wasn't initially.
Oh, I think like Jimmy Bryant.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hank Garland, you know. God, Hank Garland, his chord voicings and stuff. And, you know, the really early Les Paul stuff, you know, I'm familiar with Les, and I actually was lucky enough to know him and get to play with him. But some of that early stuff and just some of that just old, you know, I don't know the name of the steel player in Hank Williams band from the 50s, but he was so great.
Oh, I can't remember who that
and,
was.
And Chris Scruggs, who plays with Marty Stewart, he's got that old school steel guitar thing down. And that stuff's really turns me on, you know, I really think it'd be cool to find an old Fender lap steel and put that pickup in a Strat. I mean,
absolutely.
I don't know if it would work, but that honky tonk sound, you know, but I think that's what, you know, Jimmy Bryant has really got that thing that's so cool.
I think what's amazing about Jimmy Bryant to me is, and what really helped me actually, both him and like Joe Mafis, you know, Joe Mafis would just play like a gajillion miles an hour and just be clean as the day is long playing those bluegrass type of licks. But, you know, like that little rock getaway of Jimmy Bryant, I don't know if you heard that. It starts off real soulful.
It starts off real slow and then goes into that thing.
And it just goes insane.
You know, God, who sent that to me? Somebody recently sent me that, and I just listened to it, and it was just so. I think Derek O'Brien. I can't remember who sent it to me, but yeah, I played it for Gary, and Oz Noy was down playing a gig 3 days ago. I said, Oz, check this out, and I played that exact track for Oz, and he's like going, hey, can you guys send me that? I want to, you know, he's going off into it now. Yeah, it's pretty. That Little Rock Getaway is great. Yeah.
It's insane. And you listen to it, and he's pretty much immaculate. I mean, there's a couple little things here and there if you really want to get anal about it. But, I mean, there's just a bone clean tone, and he's just ripping. And then when finally YouTube came out, because I always think to myself, how could these guys be picking that stuff so immaculately? Because every time, you know, I would, you know, try to do alternate pickings back. It took me forever to get to the point where I was even somewhat competent with it. Because, you know, back in the day, all the blues and rock players, you know, like I'd watch Hendrix, you know, Jimmy Plays Berkeley, they were all downstrokes for the most part, unless he was doing some kind of a strumming lick. But all of his single note lines were all like downstrokes. So that's kind of what I did. So later on, when I tried to do the alternate picking stuff, it was an arduous situation.
Yeah. Totally.
And then years later, I remember when YouTube finally came out and I saw videos of Jimmy Bryant, because I was like, I want to see what he looks like as he's playing this stuff. Is he sitting there, you know, stressed out, just gritting his teeth, you know, and same with Joe Mafus. And these guys are sitting back, the most relaxed right hand. And I just realized, oh, this isn't a tense thing at all. It's totally loosey goosey.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a huge thing for me when I saw that and realizing these guys weren't stressing out about playing that stuff. They just did it. And they were like, oh, look at this. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I went through a pretty big Jimmy Bryant phase and got all the stuff. I learned a few of the tunes, you know, the Knight Rider. I worked on Little Rock Getaway. At one point I could do the fast part. I would have to work that sucker up again. But there's some really great phrasing in the intro part. Uh-huh. Where he's doing some of those Western swing things, but anyways, yeah, but there's obviously a ton of stuff. But were you a big Grant Green fan initially?
No, I found out about him kind of indirectly through Wes Montgomery, but I wasn't that familiar with him originally. No,
I remember same thing for me. It's like I was into, you know, George Benson, Wes Montgomery, and then when I was in college, I remember my guitar teacher up there hit me to one of the records that was. It was a later record, so it was a little more kind of 70s, you know, not the cool soul organ trio stuff or even the funk stuff he did in the late 60s. And I wasn't initially like, oh, this, it seems a little bit more basic than, you know, the other stuff. But then later on, I got into that stuff and it's just, I kind of just enjoyed his tone, and his intention and he's got a pretty... As far as a jazz player is concerned, he doesn't have the most massive vocabulary, but the way that he swings and has the tone and just kind of the ways he approaches the instrument, I was like, yeah, I get this. But that was kind of one of the later ones for me, you know, where you're just like, you've heard the name, you've heard some stuff. And then all of a sudden, I mean, I don't know about you, but I kind of do that. I was like, I'll like do the deep dive. I'll get into somebody. And I'll just be like hyper-focus, read everything about him, want to, you know, get all the records together, listen to it, and then move on to the next thing. And that's, he's one of those that I did later on where it's like, hey, what's this?
Yeah. He's cool. He's definitely cool.
And of course, I just love the sound of B3. So when he was doing the organ trio stuff and then the funky stuff, I think, you know, Scofield, when he did a lot of the funkier things, there's some definite like, nods to Grant Green's funky period. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Were you a big Scofield fan or were you already kind of set in your ways by the time he kind of came on the scene?
No, he's great. He's really great. Yeah.
I do love Scofield.
Very tasty.
He's always doing something else. You know what I mean? Always mixing it up.
Yeah. Yeah. He's
got that funky tone. And those little things like where he'll take the E string and like take it off the fretboard, and all those little.
Yeah, it's pretty original. It's great.
I dig all that stuff.
Yeah, it's great.
So next year you're going out on the G3 thing, and that's the first part of the year. And then what do you reckon you're going to do after that?
Well, I'm going to do some shows with Michael Landau.
Oh, I did see that. That's going to be awesome.
That'll be fun. Yeah, we'll do some of that stuff around the Texas area in April. And then I don't know. I need to maybe put some kind of tour together for the fall. I'd like to go to Europe.
Oh, yeah.
In Europe. So
Europe's always good. We were kind of aiming to go there in April, but I may make it later on in the year. But it's always fun going over there.
Yeah. Yeah, you go over there pretty often, don't you?
We go there a couple times a year.
Yeah.
Okay. And usually go over there for 3 weeks, two, 3 weeks, depending on what we all have lined up. And you know, three guys and the tour manager and the sprinter, you know what I mean? Scouring.
Yeah.
You know, and Klaus, our agent over there, he's really good about, you know, finding stuff every night of the week, right? So that you're always working. Mm-hmm. And at the time we're done, you know, we've made dough, it's all well and good, but I mean, there's some days where it's like, yeah, we're here and then we got to drive 8 hours. And then the next day we got to drive 7 hours back almost from where we were the day before. You know what I mean?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And just kind of making that all work. I'm not complaining. It just is what it is. But, It's hard work. I was kind of like, you know, why can't we just come over here and do like, you know, London, Paris, Cologne, Amsterdam, you know what I mean? Do the big cities and get the hell out. So that's what I'm trying to kind of focus on doing something like that in the future. But how about you? When you go over there, what kind of do you do, like, is it all like a all Europe thing, or do you concentrate on like, you know, more of a specific region at a time?
You know, I haven't been there in a number of years. That's why I need to get back to Europe, because I haven't toured there in quite a while. The last time we were there, we did all pretty much the whole, we didn't get to Eastern Europe, and I don't even know if that'd be possible at this particular time, but I'd love to go sometime, you know.
Yeah.
But we just did all the Western countries. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Kyiv would probably be off the menu for the Kiev, or as I used to say it.
Yeah.
Although I have been to Kyiv in the past, and it was a nice city, but hopefully what remains of it will be nice again at some point.
Yeah. Hope this will be ending soon, hopefully.
Yes. Yes, indeed. It's a crazy world we're living in, but luckily we have the power of rock music.
Yeah.
Of which to slake the souls of the humans.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, listen, my friend, thank you so much for taking some time to chew the proverbial gristle.
Well, thank you for having me, Greg. I enjoyed it. It's great, man.
Likewise.
Yeah.
And I hope to see you down there in Texas. I think we'll probably be down there again. And, you know, usually we do the Dallas Guitar Show and then make our way down to Austin. So.
Oh, good. And that's in April, right?
Yes. First week in May, I believe, is the Dallas Guitar Show. So then we usually come either before that or right after it. So.
Okay. Great.
We shall return.
All right. Well, it'll be good to see you then.
Likewise, my friend. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Sure, Greg. Thanks for having me, man.
A pleasure. I'll let you know when it airs.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye, Greg.
Folks, thanks so much for tuning in. We certainly do appreciate you stopping by and partaking in the most savory, chewable gristle this side of Cucamonga. Gregory Kok, looking forward to seeing you again next week, even though I won't actually see you, but I'll sense your presence.